Going to do item 11 next, which is the update on public safety. We're going to postpone items 12, 13, and 14 and see how we do for time and then pick those up probably after the CVB plan, just to try to keep ourselves on a little bit organized for the folks who come from out of the building. So we will introduce Colonel Sellers and take it away. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Morning.
With the assistance of Mr. Trevor Henry and Officer Rob Heidi, Neil Kraft, and Chief Eggleston, and Mr. Brian McPeters, I'm going to tag team this presentation this morning and provide you an update on the first phase of the public safety training facility, also known as the police firearms range. I'd like to first recognize some of our partners in this project who are here today. Chief Lehman from Scottsville Police Department. Sheriff Brown was here. I don't see him at the moment from Charlottesville. I've got Chief Deputy Bobby Shiflett from the Alamar County Sheriff's Office that was here. He may have had to step out as well. Chief Eggleston and Chief Longo from the Charlottesville Police Department, thank you for joining me today. We're going to provide this overview this morning. Is going to provide a review of the critical need. I'm going to provide that section, why the Keene property was selected, a project status, some maps and some graphics that better illustrate the location for you and the audience, a discussion on my involvement with the community and the community's input in this process, why an outdoor range is preferred, design consideration as it relates to noise, lead, environmental stewardship, and safety. Some cost estimates will be provided, and we'll discuss alternative range options and possible enhancements to our current design. We're going to also go over some project milestones with you, and then Chief Eggleston is going to talk a little bit about future phases. So as you all know, the police firearms range is the first phase of a larger concept to utilize the 169-acre county-owned landfill property in rural Keene, Virginia, to train our police, fire rescue, jail, and sheriff's departments on the critical needs they must maintain to keep our community safe. Future phases could include a burn building, some hazardous materials training facility to train our firefighters, shared classroom spaces, and a driver's training track. Give you a little bit of history on this project. In the mid-1990s, following the closure of the police firearms range at the airport property, Albemarle County and Charlottesville have been in search of a suitable location to build a replacement range. Thanks to the generosity, and it needs to be said here today, thanks to the generosity of the Rivanna Rifle and Pistol Club, a temporary solution was offered to the county and the city and our law enforcement personnel so that we could train until a permanent solution could be found. 17 years later, the city and the county's 403 law enforcement officers still train at that facility. In 2004, the police firearms range was placed on the capital improvement program, and as funding later became available, a consultant was hired to evaluate potential locations within the county, which will be discussed shortly by Mr. Henry. In 2011, the police firearms range rated as the county's most critical CIP project. I'd like to go over with you a little bit about our current state of training. I think it's important to understand. Bear with me. It's a lot of material to cover in a short amount of time. During my first year in office as police chief, I conducted a bottom-to-top assessment of the Albemarle County Police Department, where I identified several priority issues requiring attention. Public safety training, especially as it relates to firearms use, scenario-based training, and critical decision-making were identified as areas in need of critical attention. Today, our region's law enforcement agencies have limited access to a private range, which confines our training time to an average of only once a year for each police officer, the minimum required by the state of Virginia. Unfortunately, over the past 17 years, the capacity to accommodate a growing law enforcement training need, coupled with the growth of the Ravenna Range membership, have resulted in diminished training for both the city and the county. For officers requiring a higher level of firearms training, such as our SWAT team members and our firearms instructors, I've been forced to send them out of the county to other law enforcement facilities, even today. The Ravenna Range is not designed for scenario-based training or critical decision-making exercises. A professionally designed law enforcement firearms range is. Albemarle County and Charlottesville want to keep up with the best practices in public safety training to better protect our citizens. Today, we train in silos due to the training constraints we face. Tomorrow, we must leverage opportunities to train together, not only as a region, but also in a multidisciplinary approach. A little bit about risk management, I think it's important. As public safety administrators, one of our many responsibilities is to mitigate risk. In terms of local government liability, guns and driving rank near the top in terms of risk. Earlier, I stated our officers only train once a year with their firearms. The national average for law enforcement personnel is three times per year. And one in five agencies train more frequently than that. One of the best ways to mitigate risk is to improve the level of training that we offer our men and women. So why now? Why now? We have opportunity. We have a chance to improve training and safety. Let's talk about opportunity. Today, we have an opportunity to create the future and develop a public safety training model which leverages county-owned property, leverages the financial backing of our partners in the city, and supports our basic public safety infrastructure. With economic uncertainty still on the horizon, local governments must learn to leverage training needs and services through effective regional partnerships. I'm certain that this city-county partnership will be a model, we both feel this, will be a model for which other regions will want to emulate. Every day we delay is another day that we're providing less than average training for the men and women who are charged with protecting our community. Every public safety chief and sheriff here shares the colossal responsibility to ensure that our men and women return home safe each and every day to their spouses, to their children, and to their loved ones. Sadly, that doesn't always occur. Getting our law enforcement officers above the minimum required levels of firearms proficiency is critical, and timing is critical. Why a local facility? I think it's important to spend a few minutes on that. I want to speak a moment on why it's important to train in the community we serve in a facility we control. As most people are aware, Albemarle County has the leanest county police department in the state. How many times have you heard me say that? For that reason, we can't afford to employ full-time, technical, and specialized positions as larger agencies do. To meet that demand, my predecessor, to meet the demand for the highly technical and highly skilled law enforcement tasks, my predecessor created several specialized teams within the police department. Some examples of those teams: the SWAT team, K-9, hostage negotiators, crash reconstruction team, and field force. These highly trained, specialized police officers are the same officers who make up our patrol force and are responsible for patrolling our communities every day. We all wear multiple hats, and that's the only way we can get the job done. As chief, I prefer that these highly skilled and technical assets remain close to the county. Training an hour or more away erodes our ability to bring technical and tactical support rapidly to public safety emergencies. The Keene landfill is within a reasonable proximity to the county and city law enforcement assets, and officers with special skills could be called upon to respond to emergency situations fairly rapidly. At every community meeting I attended in Southern Albemarle County in 2011 and 2012, and some of you members were with me at those meetings, a predominant theme emerged in each and every meeting. Each and every meeting. The citizens wanted to see a greater police presence within their communities. A police firearms facility will bring a greater police presence to southern Alamar County. I'm confident it will increase business for the town of Scottsville and the surrounding area. Control over our own training schedule is something we do not enjoy today with our current arrangement with Rivanna. Adhering to specific pre-planned training dates sounds easy enough, doesn't it? But it's not. Unfortunately, police work often gets in the way, and officers are redeployed to handle emergencies or staffing shortages, and the training dates need to be rescheduled. When those training dates are gone, they don't come back. And so it pushes our training further and further back, or creates a situation where, again, I have to send officers out of the county. When you don't have control over your schedules, you lose that flexibility, and making up training is difficult, and you also lose the flexibility with your on-duty resources. With a locally anchored facility, you maintain the flexibility to set up and establish locally relevant training scenarios with our regional partners, who you work adjacent to each and every day. Additionally, a local facility better supports the current goal of combined multidisciplinary training. Can you imagine sending an entire fire company an hour or two out of the county so that they could train with the police department? I don't think that's something our volunteer chiefs and our professional chiefs would support or endorse. Likewise, I don't recommend sending critical law enforcement assets and equipment out of the county. Trevor.
Madam Chair, members of the board, Mr. Foley, I'm going to talk briefly on the Keene location itself. I'll give you an update on project status, and then zero in a little bit, you know, into the site itself. Ryan McPeters from our engineering firm and Officer Rob Heide will then give you more details on the design, especially as it relates to items such as noise mitigation, range safety, environmental concerns. So if you bear with us for a few minutes, we'll try to briefly go from the high level down to the detail and hopefully answer any of the questions that you might have as it relates to the proposed site or design. So I guess backing it up, Mr. Hawkins and Mr. Wood had mentioned earlier, and Colonel Sellers as well, the need and priority of a public safety training facility, including this a firing range, has been really in play for several decades. It's been in and out of the CIP and our capital needs assessment. Most recently, in 2008, funding was authorized for a TANG study that looked at three locations that were county-owned properties: the Pretty Creek site, the Byram site, and the old landfill at Keene. Some study was done, working with our public safety stakeholders to define what the needs might be, and then try to do test fits on each of those locations. The results of that study was really a recommendation that the Keene would be the only suitable site given the three, primarily due to the soils at Keene, the least impact on critical slopes, wetlands, although there is some, but the lesser impact. Additionally, it's felt that the repurposing of that site for this kind of use was favored. And as Colonel Sellers has mentioned, just the location that really allows that that regional training goals that it really isn't present currently and is important. So the recommendation out of that study was for Keene, and that's really what we've advanced with. The status of the project, as Colonel Sellers mentioned a year ago, was the number one ranked, the firearms component of it was the number one ranked CIP project that came out of technical review. It was prioritized, recommended to oversight, who endorsed it. It followed suit to the board, who authorized funding for the work to proceed. And we've been busily working through the project. We are at about a 50% phase of the design. The site plan has been submitted. We have had a couple of reviews with community development, and we're, basically on the poised to resubmit it for final site plan. The site plan was called up by a adjoining neighbor for a planning commission review, and that's scheduled for Monday. Additionally, there are some waivers that are requested related to the site that have been recommended for approval by staff and are scheduled to come back to the board in December as a consent agenda item or an action item, depending on how that decision goes. So really, the project is you know, preliminarily designed. We've incorporated feedback as best we can from the community and from the reviewers, and the public outreach process has been quite extensive over the past year and continues to be. Colonel Sellers will talk more about that throughout the presentation. Kind of back to the general location, I provided a bird's eye view of the location just to give you a sense of kind of where it sits in the southern part of the county. A couple of the public members that have commented earlier mentioned about proximity to Scottsville. Scottsville, as you look at that map, would be 4 to 5 miles to the southwest. Another gentleman mentioned Yancey Elementary School. Yancey would be, southeast is Scottsville. Southwest would be Yancey, about a mile and a half in opposite direction of the range, just to give you a sense of location. This is a image of the site plan itself. You access the site via Fortune Road or Fortune Lane, which was the same access that was used by the garbage dump trucks and garbage trucks when it was an active landfill. The design of the site, design of the range and the road is to stay off the cap, which obviously is an important piece of the design. It really circumnavigates the site. And as you can see, it's about a mile lane is the design that wraps around the site, and then it ends with a gravel parking lot and the range itself. Blowing up the range a little further shows you three ranges. Two of the smaller ranges are 50-yard range. Larger range is 110 yards. It shows you the earthen berms, which are at 20 foot high, approximately 45 in width. There is a gravel parking lot. There is a plan to have located on there a learning cottage, I think is what we call them nowadays, a semi-permanent a facility for some classroom training. There will be a vault toilet and some storage for police to store some of the gear there. You also see a stormwater management facility that's part of our quality and quantity control for any runoff. Mr. McPeters and Mr. Heide will talk in a little more detail about the design itself and the elements of the design as it relates to some of the concerns that have been raised. Next thing that really my last piece of this is to show kind of a perspective of what, you know, what the height of that range would feel. It's we're using a model called SketchUp, which basically allows you to plug the design elements into a 3D graphing model. And so you get a sense of what an officer might feel as they are shooting into the rear berm. Gives you a feel for perspective. One of the things that Officer Heide will talk about is, in addition to the earthen berm, we're going to have what are called eyebrows, which is an added element at the top of the berm. But this kind of gives you a sense of what 20 feet looks like. And then if you can bear with me for just another minute, SketchUp also allows you to do video. And so we're going to do a flyby, if you will, of what the range will look like.
Robert, can you explain what eyebrows are?
Eyebrows are an element that will sit on top of the range that will prevent any kind of, as a round would hit into the range, you know, in some cases it rolls, the round rolls up the range, it would help catch that. So it's just it's an additive element of safety.
Built on top of the berm?
Yes, sir.
So that's an extra 8 feet up and then another little...
Yeah, it kind of concaves in. Brian can talk more about that.
Are the trees on top of the berm?
There's no trees on top of the berm.
We can talk about why.
Yeah. If you can just hold that question for a minute.
And the other question I had, the school is located behind you.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
In opposite direction of the lanes.
The berms, as you picture them here. What material would you typically use for that?
Brian, do you want to step up?
The berms will be 20 feet tall at a slope of 1-to-1 on the firing side. That's to prevent the likelihood of a round traveling up the berm, which is being caught by the eyebrow. The soil in the first 18 inches to 2 feet will be a clean, filtered soil. Can't have rocks, can't have concrete, can't have anything that would cause a bullet to ricochet and leave the range. And then inside of that would just be earth and fill. And that'll be the backs, particularly the backstop and the impact side of the ranges downrange.
So the material that would be used is special material designed for this use?
Well, it's just soil, but the soil on the surface and where the round would impact the backstop or the edges of the side berms that would be impacted will be either a select material brought in from outside that has a certain high specification to be met, that they not have rocks, not have anything in it trash related that could cause a ricochet and then influence a bullet potentially leaving the range. And the material in the backstop itself will be material we excavate to build the project on the site. So, but there will be constraints and specifications and special provisions in the contract for the contractor to build that.
Thank you.
Pretty confident.
Before we leave that, I just want to ask a question so that our audience understands this. I didn't know that they'd have been called up at the Planning Commission again next week. Can you explain what the impact of that is? I mean, they have no authority to change anything, correct? I mean, it's just another information.
It's correct. The Planning Commission approved the use in a comp plan review back in April, March, April timeframe.
Right.
And Larry can probably better answer this. As part of the site plan review process, it was called, but it Planning Commission can review it in terms of the design of the site itself, not as a use, as I understand it.
That's correct. It's not a special use permit process. It's just a ministerial site plan review. The role of the Planning Commission is to make sure that all the zoning ordinance requirements are met that are applicable to the project, but they don't have discretion to add additional conditions or require modifications that are not inconsistent with the
Does this precipitate another review by the board, by us?
It does not require review by the board, except for the waivers that are associated with it.
Schedule for December.
And those are just related to the gravel versus asphalt drive.
They're pretty standard modifications that are granted in development projects.
Okay. I'm pretty confident that any other questions you have regarding the details of the construction and design, we're going to cover. I tried to put together a pretty good, solid presentation, so we'll see how that unfolds here shortly. But I wanted to speak a little bit about community input, and I want to state for the record that the community around the Keene landfill have been absolutely gracious. They've been perfect gentlemen and ladies, and I've enjoyed meeting with them and discussing this project with them all along. So I said from the very beginning of this project, we intend to work with the community in the development and management of this project, to best balance the public safety training needs and being good neighbors. I do support the community's wishes and endorse it in terms of participating in the development of what I'll refer to as a good neighbor policy or good neighbor agreement, which may lay out some written conditions on such things as training hours and training days and noise monitoring and those kinds of things. I'm all for that. I have no problems with any of that. But just to sum up some of the community input and outreach efforts that this project has gone through, in mid-January 2011, Chief Eggleston and I sent a letter to each property owner within a half a mile of the proposed range, providing a short overview of the county's plans for the landfill property.
Can I clarify? You said 2011. Did you mean 2011 or 2012?
2011.
Okay, so over a year ago.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Thank you. It says 12 here, so I'm confused.
I'm sorry, 2012. You're right.
Okay.
Not over a year ago.
It said 12 on the screen. That's why I just wanted to make sure where we were.
Thank you. And we also indicated in our letter that we had planned to come through the neighborhood on a subsequent day, the following week, to go door to door. So the following week, myself, Chief Eggleston, Sheriff Harding, Sheriff Brown from the city, and law enforcement leaders from the city and county made home visits to the neighboring property owners in order to share a more detailed information and answer questions and to gain input. We didn't go outside the half-mile ring. We stayed pretty much within the half-mile radius of the range. In an effort to be as transparent as possible and upon the suggestion of a neighbor during that home visit, the Elmore County Police Department established a public website in March of 2012 to allow the community to track the project. Since that time, the ACPD has met several times with neighbors, both collectively and individually, throughout the summer and fall. My staff and I publicly spoke about the new range and fielded a number of questions during 4 town hall meetings in southern Elmore County from February through September of this year. In April, as we discussed before, this plan went before the Planning Commission and the public, where residents offered additional comment. And as also we discussed, it returns to the Planning Commission next week. Recently, we posted an FAQ, a Frequently Asked Questions segment on our webpage, which sort of answers some of the top 4 concerns that were raised in some of the discussions in the media that include environmental concern, lead management, safety, and noise. We also, on our ACPD Facebook page, produced and posted a video, informational video, that Chief Longo and I did together and posted that on our site so that people could follow. I'm going to let Officer Heidi and Brian McPeters talk a little bit about the design and why we want to go outside.
Morning. Good to see you guys again. So a lot of conversation has been had about indoor versus outdoor. And what I want to say before I jump into the details is that in 2007, the same conversation was had. And the design of this facility was not done in a vacuum. It wasn't done in a vacuum in 2007, and it hasn't been done in a vacuum currently. All else being equal, money not being an object, we would still choose an outdoor facility because of what it avails for training. Some of those details are the type of training it allows. It covers the gamut of law enforcement training. Qualification training, which is very static, and some call it tactical training, I call it scenario-based training, where you look at data from officer-involved shootings around the country and you learn from that officer's death so that it is not wasted. We turn that into a scenario that we can build on our range, and hopefully officers that attend that training can take something away that'll serve them the next day, a year, 10 years down the road. So it supports tactical qualification, scenario-based training. It allows you to move freely. There are no hardscapes in our range design. There's no sidewalks. There's no roofs over the shooting lines just for weather. There's none of that. So there's free movement. There's an open floor plan of each of these ranges that permits that. Supporting multiple shooting positions. I can tell you in law enforcement, when you get into a physical fight with people, you end up on the ground. It's just a fact of life. So teaching officers that they can break the habit of having to get to their feet before they can shoot is a way of better training them for realistic scenarios on the street. Talk a little bit about investment and cost differences. We are building 3 ranges for the price of far less of a price of 1 indoor range. And I'll get into some of those dollar details in a little bit. But basically, our outdoor project is a third of the cost for 1 indoor facility. And that's just building it. That's not operating it. Speaking of operating costs, far less expensive to operate an outside range. The driving force behind that are OSHA regulations. There is a myriad of OSHA regulations regarding indoor facilities. That's both a government facility or a private commercial facility. The OSHA regulations are intense. Outside, they don't seem to have that type of specificity. And then the other thing that it does is it supports joint training and maximizing our partnerships. When you have multiple ranges, you can do multiple things. Doesn't increase the number of people there. It just makes the training more efficient. So if we want to have a Charlottesville and Albemarle day where we designed through a scenario-based training mechanism, an active shooter response, we have several different ranges to be able to accomplish that training on. So, again, all else being equal, money not being an object, we would choose the outdoor range facility for all those reasons. Trevor.
And then getting into some of the design elements, the biggest design element in dealing with a range, whether we're talking about an indoor range or an outdoor range, is probably the noise mitigation. This is the one, since it's been brought up, that the NRA range source book would ask that you pay special attention to. And we've done that at the beginning stage of this project, and we'll continue to do that throughout the completion of the final design. So how are we minimizing noise impacts and mitigating noise the best we can? And let's clarify that we're talking about noise, because we're going to measure noise in decibels, which is a measure of intensity. We're not talking about the ability of a sound to be heard. So noise and sound being heard, because things are certain decibels and a certain intensity, makes them easier to be heard, but it does not measure in any way whether you or I will hear that particular sound-reducing event, okay? So primarily what we're talking about with noise mitigation on outdoor range is the berms and the sidewalls. On the range as it's designed currently, our backstop and our side berms are an elevation of approximately 20 feet from the firing line. Those berms will mitigate noise from the high-intensity levels coming out the barrel of the weapon being fired, which would be upwards of 90 to over 100 decibels at the barrel or the muzzle of the fired piece. The berm thereby reflects and or dissipates noise to a level that gets it to the point where once you're at the property line, it's not at that high level of intensity. And that noise level is also, you know, mitigated through things that are surrounding the Crean property, which make it ideal for the use, which is the size of the property itself. So we talked, the Crean property is over 150, 160 acres. A lot of that, obviously, is the cap. Approximately 40 to 50 acres of it is actual landfill, unusable space that we have to stay off of and avoid since it is a closed landfill. And it's surrounded by a vegetated tree buffer both on the county property and off. And that vegetation, again, helps with the mitigation. The range has been situated to not tear down a bunch of trees at the property's edge that we'd lose that ability to mitigate it. The next piece of our noise mitigation is not so much a design issue as it is how we schedule the use. So the police department has talked with the neighbors. They've talked about it being during business hours primarily, and that would include seldom, but maybe possibly occasionally weekend or holiday use based on training requirements, but that would be a seldom deal. And then it's not as if the range goes live at, say, 8 a.m. on an average training day and then continues firing until 5 p.m. So if we have an 8-hour on average training day, approximately 2 hours of that will be spent in the classroom going over the scenario-based training event and the use of the range, safety procedures, all the different things that make a range work. Then the folks in the classroom could go to the range, do their scenario-based training. But again, it's not like I'm going to go to the range and pull the trigger for 5 to 6 straight hours. You'll note on the plans that we have, we don't have a targeting system. Therefore, if we have targets and we're static, that means we're going to have to fire, go get our targets, and clear the range before we go get them and bring them back. So, it's not that we're going to have 5 to 6 hours of someone always pulling the trigger. It will be an intermittent noise generation throughout the day based on the training regimen, which we can get into more details with Officer Heidi if necessary.
One question before you leave. What's the floor of the range going to be? Because one of the things we're hearing is that there's a lead mist or something that comes out at the time that you shoot a weapon that will go into the soil and then drain into the watershed. Is there some kind of special?
That is correct. So the range itself will primarily be grass and or stone dust covered because we have to have a covering of the range. Obviously, it wouldn't cause a ricochet of a round to leave the range.
Right.
With that in mind, there are things that we can do that Officer Heidi's going to talk about now from lead management, and we do have two primary lead management issues. One is the one everyone thinks about, which is the round, the spent round in the backstop, and then the particulate, which Officer Heidi will talk about in a second.
Yep.
Okay, so we basically use three manuals in designing this range. The primary one that we use is a manual produced by the EPA called Best Management Practices at Outdoor Shooting Ranges. We kind of turn that manual into our Bible, and we either meet or exceed the standards of that manual. The two other manuals we used is an NRA range construction specification manual where they have blueprints and dimensions and things for different types of infrastructure, and then also the National Shooting Sports Foundation range management manual. So in the EPA manual, they talk about four steps to lead management. The first one is control and contain. That gets into the designing of the range, what the range is built to be, and how much forethought went into the range design that makes the cleaning up of the lead easier and more economical. So the back, if you think about a range, the part that you shoot into is called the backstop. The backstop is designed to be 45 feet thick, 20 feet high. Okay, the side berms don't need to be anywhere near that, but that's one of the standards we exceeded. Our side berms can serve as a backstop. They are the same dimension. We didn't want to go with a substandard characteristic to the side berms because they are equally as important to us. So every berm on the range is 45 feet thick, 20 feet high. The step two is prevent migration. Several different aspects to this. There's two different types of lead characteristics on a range. There's the bullet, which is in the backstop, and then there's the particulate that you asked about that goes out the end of the barrel and settles to the range deck. Preventing migration prevents both of those type of lead characteristics on a range. So we're going to prevent migration through soil testing. We will monitor the soil at various places on the facility. And the ideal pH balance that we're looking for is 6.5 to 8.5. And based on that, it will kick into gear other steps for treating the soil to keep that pH balance there. Immobilizing the lead, we do that through physically immobilizing it, which has to do with the design. The eyebrows do two things. Primarily, they help prevent ricochets and rounds leaving the range by increasing the height of the berm. But because they have an overhang, they also keep rainfall from impacting the slope of the berm as much as it would if it was unprotected, which creates erosion and allows water to come into contact with the lead. The other thing to immobilizing lead is binding the lead, and that's done through a very clay soil, which is one of the reasons Keene was selected. It has very high clay content, and it's also done by proper pH level in the soil. It causes that lead to bind so that it doesn't dissolve and create migration.
Somewhere in the write-up, Rob, it seemed to me that it said that the cleanup would occur something like every million rounds. And in time frequency, do we have any idea, based on the proposed use, how often that would happen?
Excellent segue into step three, which is remove and recycle.
Okay. You may be going to cover this question
right,
anyway.
Right. Thank
you.
The EPA suggests, and all of their suggestions are just that. They have no mandates, except when you clean a range up. So the EPA suggests 100,000 rounds per firing position. So what does that mean? With the regional use we're anticipating, with the number of rounds we are anticipating being fired, and this is a moving target slightly, we're looking at the 3 to 4 year range where we would hire a company to come in, and this is an EPA licensed company, to come in and remove the lead, sift it, package it, and then rebuild those berms, and then haul the lead off to sell at a recycling center, and that would help offset the cost of removing it in the first place. So that's step three, is remove and recycle. And then step four is record keeping. Very specific.
Just so I understand, how many rounds, you say in the 3 to 4 year period we're talking about, how many rounds would you have anticipated would have been fired in that?
That's how we got to that 3 to 4
right,
years.
I'm trying
million.
To get the total number of rounds.
Is a million.
100,000 per
lane.
Lane.
So if you have, if we have, I don't know, 15 lanes on the range, that's 150,000. That's 1.5 million.
1.5 million.
Right. So we just kind of took that number and worked backwards based on judgment and some swags regarding how much the range would be used, and it got us to a 3 to 4 year time frame.
Why is it that for the lead that comes out where the shooter is, why wouldn't you just have mats?
Well, it's a particulate. I mean, that you're dealing with stuff
things that you can remove and wash off
on the molecular level. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know why you couldn't just have rubber. I'm certainly no expert in the area, but if you're standing there and you're emitting lead in what you're doing, it would seem to me if you had something under your feet, a rubber mat or something like that, that could be taken up and washed weekly or something to get the lead off of it, it would make a difference. But maybe not.
Well, there are ranges that do that, but they are a much more confined shooting area. Because if you would still have to remove it somehow, sure. So a range of our size, you know, trying to roll up mats that you put into a barrel or something to get hauled away is not practical.
So really. People would be shooting at various positions along the distance between each end.
That's right.
So to speak. Okay.
That's right.
Thank you.
So record keeping would be kept for the life of the range so we can judge our performance. Go ahead, John.
And going hand-in-hand with the lead management plan is something called the Environmental Stewardship Plan. And the Environmental Stewardship Plan is going to be the guiding document that verifies that our design keeps the environmental concerns that we have to use on the range, which primarily is lead, to a manageable standpoint that meets the requirements of the stewardship program, which meets the requirements of the laws, which meets the requirements of Albemarle County and the police department. And we're going to be doing that through the use of a specialty sub-consultant to write the Environmental Stewardship Plan for this particular project. That environmental stewardship plan will not just go over things about design, which I'll talk about in a second, but it will also go over how the range is used. So things like the million rounds before reclamation, the treatment of the soil or the rock stone dust on the range floor itself with lime to kind of grab the lead particles, so to speak, and grab them so they can be transported to the stormwater management basin, which we'll talk about in a second. Is all part of that environmental stewardship plan. And just by the way, we are using a nationally recognized expert to help craft this particular ESP, who actually is a speaker at the NRA's range design conferences that they held nationwide. So we knew this was a concern. It's one we have to keep our eye on. That is nothing that's uncommon to any design of any firing range, and we wanted to make sure that we had the right people on our team to serve the county to grab that. So talking from us...
Have we done an estimate of the operational costs of maintaining this facility?
There is. Rob could probably speak.
Sounds like, you've got ongoing maintenance requirements having to do with environmental issues and other things. I didn't see that in our information, but maybe
it's in CIP documentation. Mm-hmm. The first year estimate is $10,000. The
environmental?
Just overall $10,000 to operate that range.
In here it says we would intend to have a full-time employee there. Says the firing range would be staffed by the county police department when training is being conducted, and that would be
those are instructors that would be there no matter where we're training. So it's not just because we have our own facility. Those are, and I'll get into that with the safety discussion. But $10,000 is our estimate for the first year, and then inflation on top of that. At that third and fourth year time, we're looking at $25,000-$30,000 for the lead removal, and then some of that offset with the salvage.
Okay, so our environmental stewardship plan works hand-in-hand with our stormwater management plan. So typically on a development project, as everyone in this room is probably aware, we have to focus on two things, the quantity of our runoff and the quality of our runoff. Obviously, on this particular site, we're in a rural area. We're bringing what is not impervious area, but will be area that could transport sediment. Therefore, we have to treat the quality and make sure that we're not degrading the downstream channels that exist on the site that have already been mentioned both by the public and during Mr. Henry's part of the presentation. But on this particular project, since we are dealing with the lead particulate, we have to also design our stormwater management system to address that. So we do that in a couple ways. One particular situation that will be hashed out but is a possibility in the environmental stewardship plan is to treat the range floor with a lime dust. That lime dust will then bind to the lead particulate, making it easier for the lead particulate to translate its way via the stormwater runoff and or the stormwater management system, the conduits, the pipes, the inlets, to a detention basin. It's basically a hole in the ground. It will not have a wet pool. That detention basin will have a clay liner in it that will prevent the lead particulate bound to the lime from escaping from the basin. And similar to the reclamation of the lead spent bullets, we will also, over time, which we haven't identified on this particular range design yet what that time limit will be, we'll have to actually go in and clean out the clay liner, replace the clay liner, thereby removing the lead particulate from the stormwater basin design. at that point, once we have the lead particulate basically contained to the detention basin, we can then deal with offline water quality treatment, which will also help us. And any lead that would, for some reason, not be detained in the detention basin would then go through the filtration system, the biofilter, and then we also clean out the biofilter with time. So the environmental stewardship plan itself will govern all of those things and set the standards of which when we have the rounds. Now, someone asked about, well, how come we don't put trees on top of the berms? That's a great question. The reason for that is approximately every 3 to 4 years, we're going to have to go into the backstop and basically deconstruct the backstop and take the rounds out using a specialty contractor who's going to reclaim that lead, rebuild the backstop back. And quite honestly, since our backstop is a one-to-one slope, that's not a typical design slope that we'd use. So basically for every 1 foot we go up vertically, you go 1 foot horizontally. That is to prevent a round from impacting the backstop and leaving the range. We want that as steep as we can be. Over time, that 3 to 4 year period, we're going to have to deal with erosion on the berm anyway, and we'll reconstruct the berm based on erosion when we reclaim the lead from the backstop.
What does reconstruction of a berm cost typically?
Believe it or not, of the, which we'll get into in a second, of the current estimates for the project budget, if the project were, it was a $1.4, $1.3 million construction project, the cost of the construction of the range, the parking lot, the classroom, the vault trailer is roughly about $300,000 to $400,000, and then we're spending the majority of the money either dealing with permitting costs that we have to deal with, building the roadway into the site. So you're looking at some fraction of that $300,000, less than $100,000 if I had anticipated. I don't have a number off the top of my head unless you did. But that's been factored into their numbers.
For all the Burmese, that's factored into the ongoing operation.
Correct. It has been.
Expense incurred over a period of time.
Are you referring to building it back after the ledge put out?
I guess he's saying every 3 or 4 years you basically remove the berms to
remove the
impact.
The impact
areas. I just was wondering what the cost was then of, and maybe Trevor's got, maybe we're going to see some numbers here, but the cost, if you have to do something every 3 years to clean them out and also partially rebuild them, what that cost is.
It's the putting the range, the berm back is included in that cost of removing the lead. So every 3 to 4 years, it's going to cost $25,000 to $30,000 for the lead removal project, which includes building the berm back.
Thank you.
What's the average depth of a round going into a slope like that? Is it a foot?
Well, that varies the more shooting you have because you create what are called hot spots. In the EPA manual, they recommend that clean field depth be 18 to 24 inches. We're taking it to 4 feet deep.
So 45 feet.
So if they're recommending 18 to 24 inches, the round probably doesn't penetrate that far. But we're going 4 feet further or 2 feet further.
Where we're shooting right now, the range on Old Lynchburg Road, are they doing all these things? Do they bring the EPA? What are they doing to mitigate lead in soil?
They're being a private club. They might be under a slightly different microscope or need to follow those regulations as much as we are. I'm not sure what they do. I know on their indoor range, they mitigate that by having the collection trays pulled out and emptied over time. I'm not really sure for the outdoor.
I don't know a whole lot of the specifics, but I did talk to a member out there who said they had to put in an extensive plan a couple of years ago to reclaim. Yeah, I don't know what the details of that were, but I know that they were required by the EPA to do something sizable.
Let's talk a little bit about safety. Safety is accomplished both through the design of the facility and the staffing of it. So when we go to the range with 12 to 14 officers that train, we have 5 instructors there with them. 4 of those instructors are there to run the line of fire, look out for their 2, 3, 4 students, if you'll call them that, and make sure they're doing the right things and doing it safely. The 5th person is in the background watching the total picture, and they're looking for someone walking onto the range possibly. As in Rivanna, we can't control it, so we have to look out for somebody walking in. Wildlife crossing the range, believe it or not, with all the gunfire at Rivanna, when we're there, you'll have a deer pop over the berm and jet across the range and go back over the other side. So there's wildlife implications. The courses that we fire, the more intense and the more realistic the course, the smaller the student-instructor ratio becomes. So I mentioned a physical fight ending up on the ground. If we're teaching a technique where you shoot from the ground, that's going to be a one-to-one instructor-student ratio. And that instructor is going to be looking for proper technique. They're going to be looking for the alignment of the weapon in relation to the target. And they're going to be right on top of that shooter. If they start to do anything wrong, they can put their hand there or they can call a ceasefire to help prevent that accident. So staffing is the big part. And Ms. Rooker, to your question about costs of staffing, that's what we do wherever we train. So if we go to Harrisonburg for a day, which we've had to do, we take our instructors with us. They're there. Rivanna, they're there. Augusta, they're there. So it's not built into the CIP cost because it's stuff we'd be doing anyway.
Your personnel.
Right.
Okay.
So further safety factors?
There would not be somebody on site 8 hours a day that's kind of a person that's assigned to oversee the site, so to speak.
That's correct. And okay. And the intent and taking advantage of our partnerships is we can ensure that there are sole people responsible for when that department is using the range. And then those two people can talk and make sure everything's being done consistent and according to the rules and according to any agreements we may have with the public. So talking about the design of the range, the shooting points of the facility will all be within the structure of the berms. So there will be no shooting outside of those berms. Furthermore, the impact areas will be the deepest half of the range facility. So that's the area where there will be 4 feet of clean fill. That's the area that will be covered by the eyebrows that we described earlier. And that's all to put the lead in a place that makes it efficient for the lead reclaimer to remove it. They don't have to hunt for it. They know exactly where it is. But it also allows us to keep the bullet impacts in the more protected section of the range, the most protected section of the range. And we're going to have signage up to make sure no targets are put in improper areas, that all of the bullet impacts occur where they're intended and designed to occur. The other part of the safety is effective maintenance. We've talked about effective staffing. We've talked about effective designing, but it's also effective maintenance. This is not your run-of-the-mill push a dirt bank up on a remote farm somewhere and start shooting. It's intended to last for decades. With the proper maintenance, with the proper record keeping, nothing should happen. It's, you know, we can't guarantee no accidents will ever happen, and you can't guarantee that just driving to work. But through the effective design, staffing, and maintenance, we're really looking forward to this facility being a model for other jurisdictions that are trying to do the same thing.
One of the issues that's been raised has been safety for people outside of the facility, stray shots. Do we have any? Are there any statistics on stray shot accidents that, with respect to shooting ranges around the country and outdoor shooting ranges?
I, to answer your question, yes. More specifically, is there data regarding accidents relating to police ranges? I couldn't find any. I know one of the members of the public that spoke ran down a list of incidents, but I don't know how to qualify those, whether they were random, you know, if there was a criminal aspect 2 blocks away and somebody got injured from that, or if it was a commercial range, I just don't know. But we have burned up the records. I've burned up the phone lines trying to find that data, and either no one's keeping it for whatever reason or there's not enough to keep. But I was asked a similar question at a town hall, and the only thing that I could really say to put it in perspective is to relate it to hunting. There are a myriad of hunting accidents across the state. We've had them here in Albemarle. And there's so much concern built into the design of this facility because of the potential of hunting accidents that it would have to be a hugely negligent oversight for a round to leave that range. And again, you know, you can't say, I can't guarantee that it will never happen, but there are no guarantees in this line of work. What I can say is the guarantee that we've painstakingly designed this to ensure that that doesn't happen and also to mitigate the lead impacts. That's what I can guarantee.
Recognizing there might be an apples and oranges comparison, what has been the history at Rivanna? I mean, has there been a – have you had accidents there? Have you had people's homes getting shot? Have you had – and I recognize that's probably not as going to be as good of a site as what you're talking about building. Right.
Before Rivanna did some enhancements, I was aware of one law enforcement round leaving that range. And the realistic training that they were doing at the time, coupled with a range facility not designed for law enforcement use, helped contribute to that accident. They have since raised their berms, and they have since put eyebrows on top of that. Hasn't happened again. The other incidents I'm aware of are where officers have mishandled a weapon, which could happen anywhere. It has really nothing to do with the range. It had to do with being unfamiliar with the weapon system, to be honest with you. So accidents happen. But the guarantee is we have left no stone unturned designing this facility.
Do you have an image of the eyebrows in your picture? Because I can sort of picture what I understood was a wall and then a angled thing that, as if it were a roof, but the other half is missing. And that would keep sound in some as well as the rounds.
When we left our meeting the other day, I went and started looking and could not find.
I'll just use my mental image, then.
Okay. Could not find a good image.
What's the size of it and the construction material?
It varies. There's no one way of doing it. Some of the material are railroad ties. Some of the material is steel with some type of coating on the front. Other material is built wooden box that's filled with gravel. They take many forms. The height average is probably going straight up from the berm 6 or 8 feet and then out at a 45-degree angle over the berm at another 6 or 8 feet. So, you know, adding what would the equivalent, you know, would be 8 or 9 feet of height to the top of the berm. And the other thing that we didn't mention in the design is that there is existing natural grade behind the berm. I think it's a minimum of 12 feet or so. Trevor might be able to correct me if I'm wrong. And a little bit higher than that at various points behind the backstop.
Is there vegetative cover on that natural grade right now? Is there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That's some of the pines.
I wouldn't want to mislead. Not completely. The cap would not be covered in vegetation. But the stream area that was undisturbed by the cap beyond that is.
In the video, the sort of flyover thing we were looking at, the, I guess, simulation, it looked as if there were a ridge, and I think that's what you're speaking about now. And are there any scrubby pines or anything on that ridge?
The majority of the ridge is the cap.
Okay.
But beyond the cap, on the county property, is a fairly sizable ravine that is very heavily wooded with pines and other types of trees and whatnot, that, to the point, quite honestly, it would be difficult to navigate your way through that to get to the road that we're improving to get from Fortune Lane to the range.
Okay, moving on to cost estimates. We've spent a lot of time talking about the infrastructure and just, you know, quickly going through that. It's the roads, it's the berms. There's been an additive cost of wetland delineation and permitting related to the wetlands to mitigate that. Semi-permanent classroom, vault toilet, and then three ranges. The current estimate with our site plan submission is $1.6 million. What was appropriated over a year ago, or what was approved and then appropriated, just over $1 million. There is an incremental cost increase based on the current design. That request has gone through the CIP process and is in front of the Oversight Committee as a recommendation to include in next year's budget. Based on the timing of the project currently, we would be in construction in the summer, and the timing is such that would allow completion of the project. I should note that the city remains committed to sharing the cost. We had a thorough project review in the August time frame as we were submitting the site plan. We reviewed the design, specifically the addition of that third range, the 110-yard range, and the timing of that. And that is one of the elements that has caused a slight bump in the cost. Talking again about construction costs, not operating and ongoing costs after that.
First, let me say I don't want to come across as being negative about this because I've met several times with members of the police department to talk about this. We obviously need a better training facility available than we have today. We certainly the intergovernmental cooperation here is important and a great aspect of it. But I do think we, when Chief Sellers is presenting the advantages of doing this, he talks about things that are not planned for this firing range. And so we talk about this as though this is the first phase, and it's $1.6 million. We talk about having, places available to do more situational things, for a number of other activities. When we talk about interdisciplinary, we're talking about disaster, training for different circumstances and situations that can arise. All of those things have their own physical needs with respect to the site and have their own activity impacts on the site. And so I guess one of the concerns I have here is that we don't, we're talking about the advantages of having our own facility because we can do all these important things that we're not, some of which we're not doing at all now, apparently, because we don't have any place to do them. But when we're looking at the impacts on the site and the eventual cost of doing this, we're looking at only a piece of it. And that bothers me. People have brought up this facility in Nottoway, and I there may be reasons why we don't use that facility. I don't know, but they spent $25 million on it, and most of that money was state money, so our taxpayers helped pay for it. And they have a plethora of things available, outdoor, indoor, driving ranges, for different kinds of accident simulations and that kind of thing. It's about an hour and a half away. I understand that I'd much rather, if I were in the police department, the fire department, I'd much rather have the facility 20 miles away than an hour and a half away. I understand that. But on the other hand, they spent $25 million on that facility. So, and they staff it, as I understand it, with eight full-time employees. So the question is, in my mind, is what are we getting into here in total here? Are we going down a road of trying to build a facility? And then in order to afford it, do we have to bring in, we talk about bringing in, other law enforcement agencies and letting them use the facility to help pay for it. Sounds like a great idea, but it also increases the scope of the activity on the site. I just want to make sure that the decision we ultimately make here provides people with the best training available at an understood and reasonable cost to the taxpayer and in a location that makes sense. And so I guess part of the problem I'm having is that I see all this and it looks great. It looks good. And there are, I do think when we break down the number of shots taken, the number of shots taking place there, it's about 2.5 per minute for if you're looking at it on like a 10-hour, 10 hours a day open, 7 days a week. You'd have, if you live near the area, you'd have 2.5 shots going off per minute. What is the impact of that, given the distance of people, et cetera? I don't know. But it is some impact.
Madam Chair, we still have some more slides. In fact, we're going to talk about the other parts of the facility and so forth. Those are all good questions for sure. There's a few more parts of the presentation which should answer some of the questions.
Great, thanks.
All right, so we've heard a lot from the public in our dealings with them, both talking with them individually at town halls and then even in some of the comments earlier for alternatives. And Madam Chair, you actually tasked the police department and Mr. Foley with bringing you some information on what alternatives were and what the potential cost. So working together as a project team, we've investigated the opportunities that you see on the screen that could, starting at the top, supplement the current design. Okay, so these costs are add-ons to the 1.6 you saw on the previous slide that would do some further mitigation of the noise. Now, we've not, to say that any of these options, until you get down to bullet three, drastically reduce the chance of sound being heard off the site at differing distances would be not true. So, but understand that they would lower the decibel level, lower the sound intensity. So the first option we looked at is what are known as ballistic or acoustic walls. These ballistic or acoustic walls would, in essence, replace either every berm on the project or just the exterior berms. The ballistic material would have a sound mitigating component to it that would help capture some of the sound, as opposed to the berms dissipating or dispersing and or redirecting noise in different directions, thereby reducing the decibel levels. These acoustical walls are a technology that would be used to lessen the noise impact potentially. Now, those walls are obviously expensive, and if you want to do the math and talk about cleaning out the backstop, for example, those walls cost on average of 1.3. If you put two to three of them on a range, that's still looking at 2.6. The other thing that we were asked to report back to you on would be the cost of a bullet trap system. A bullet trap system that would run the length, help me here, Rob, make sure I'm right, run the length of the ranges we have shown in the site plan. That's correct, right? Would be approximately $1.2 million, and that bullet trap also would, obviously helps you with lead mitigation. It does have some sound impacts, but it also creates some other sound potential issues that would have to be evaluated. And then the third bullet would be an indoor range, and it's important with the indoor range to understand, not just because the police department wants to tell you or believes that they need a range like we've designed on the ground outside. This is a price just for one indoor 50-yard range, which drastically would reduce the scenario-based training that Colonel Sellers just talked to you about. But you can see that the price, for one-third of that price, we can build the outdoor range, have all the scenario-based training that we're talking about, versus a $4 to $5 million cost. That cost is not operational cost, Mr. Rooker. So if you could think of maintaining a building and all the lead and the OSHA requirements that come with running an indoor range, those costs are going to be higher than that, which is projected in the CIP. Then lastly is the Scottsville Tire Plant. This is an existing building that's 200,000 square feet, is that correct, roughly, located in the northwest area, the Scottsville area. It's a current vacant building. If the county, which we'll have a whole slide for this in a second, would buy that building and look to upfit it with just one indoor 50-yard range, which you say, well, wait a second, it's 200,000 square feet. We're trying to compare apples to apples just to give you an idea. Just to have one indoor 50-yard range, you're talking about a floor-level cost entry here of approximately $8 to $12 million that we'll talk about some risk in those numbers. But that's just to deal with some things that we would know for certain we'd have to do and to build the actual indoor range on Keene, there, the third bullet, inside of the tire plant.
And that does not include the lease or purchase of the building?
That does include the $1.2 million-ish purchase of the building in that number.
Do you have any decibel reduction estimates for option one there, even order of magnitude, rough? What are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a good question. It depends on who you talk to. So if you talk to the manufacturers of the acoustic walls, they obviously would tell you that it has a pretty decent noise reduction, which I can let Rob speak to here in a second. If you talk to the sound consultant world, they would tell you because you're still dispersing and redirecting sound, that's somewhat debatable. But I'll let Rob, do you know that answer as far as?
Exactly. Okay. All right. Yeah, the acoustic walls work as long as it's for the sound that's headed in that direction.
Correct, but it still will bounce off and redirect some sound.
And redirect, right.
And it depends on where the shooter is, where the muzzle of the gun is pointed, which firing lane he is in. So it's hard to give an exact number, but I will, to be honest, it's, if you talk to the guy selling you the product, it's this nice, wonderful thing. If you talk to the guys dealing with the sound model, it's a little less clear cut.
Is that the cost for all the walls altogether?
2.6, I believe, would be the three walls. Is that correct? Four walls. And 1.3 would be, I think, that we were trying to say if that's, we just did one or both of the two qualification berms. They're roughly about a little less than $1 million a piece, I guess, is the way you can look at it.
You have another slide in the future that talks about other phases, right?
But that is correct.
We do right at the very end.
Like two more slides.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I do understand that the sort of scenario training, the flexibility where you're going to bring cars on and set up things, that would all happen in what you're proposing in phase one, as far as being able to use that whole open space in any number of different ways.
That is correct.
During the day when they wouldn't be shooting, they would be doing other things in there.
And that's an important note. I mean, if you looked at our range and it was strictly a static position and that's all we were talking about, we would have too many lanes. So the range is not designed to get a certain number of individuals onto the range. It's designed for the scenario-based training that Colonel Sellers talked about.
So we'll talk a little bit about what else is out there that we can use that we have to travel to. We identified Augusta County, Stanton, Augusta, and Waynesboro have a regional firearms training facility at their landfill that those three departments built and they use with no fees. Their fee for an outside department is $500 a day.
Per person or per
department.
You take six people over there, it's $500.
Take six or 60, it's $500 a day.
Okay.
There's associated travel costs with that. So we looked at Augusta County costing us about $1,063 a day to train, to take 17 people there for training. If we go three times a year, which is the national average and our training goal, we're looking at something that's about $25,500 a year. So we looked at Harrisonburg as well. They have no fees associated with their facility, but their facility is small. Getting on it may be not guaranteed when you want to or if at all.
Augusta, how big is that facility?
I would guess it's my 1.5 times the size of one of our ranges. So it's not as big as what we're proposing.
You would be using it and no one else would be there that day. That would be the
day
that you would sign up.
They have two ranges. So
okay.
They could rent one out and rent one out and you have two different departments there.
It would not have the open area for you to do the...
No, you could.
You could, okay.
It's designed very much like ours. It's just not as big because they don't have the personnel need for it. Harrisburg, about $28,500 a year, additional travel costs associated with that. Henrico has a very nice facility. They are, the second furthest away, at about 150 miles round trip, and we would be looking at a training cost there of about $45,200. That's for each officer to go three times a year. And let me just back up and state a couple of assumptions here that I made. One is that all the facilities will and can accommodate us. And these are figures just for our department. These are not regional figures. The second thing is that all facilities have the available time. The third assumption is that while we're asking and trying and our goal is to train three times a year, that doesn't take into account the one day a month that the SWAT team needs for their training. It doesn't take into account any type of remedial training where we can take a group of troubleshooters out and give them very specific attention. So this is just three times a year for the average officer.
So this would be three times. All these are three times a year.
That's correct.
When you mentioned Augusta County being designed, having a similar design, was that 20-foot berms with an eyebrow?
No, it's not. When I say similar design, theirs isn't that big.
Okay.
When I say similar design, I mean open arrangement, not indoor. All of these ranges are, except for one, and I'll get to that in a second, are outdoor ranges. And all of them, except for one, are law enforcement. Okay. There's one private range thrown in here.
Is there any ranges in the vicinity that has the 20-foot berms and the eyebrow that you're talking about?
None come to mind. None come to mind. The closest one, both in design and location, might be Henrico, but not even their entire range. So the design of this facility is not
You're going above and beyond anything else.
That's right.
Being constructed.
In terms of protecting against stray shots
all
and that kind of
thing. And sound.
And sound.
And sound.
That's right. The commercial range we looked at, Colonial Shooting Academy in Richmond, that's a repurposed furniture warehouse and factory on Broad Street right at the interstate, $33 million facility. We would be looking at about $50,000 a year to take officers there. They charge $800 a day or $84 an hour for that. And their ranges cannot accommodate all of our training because it's an indoor facility. They don't have the distances needed. So we would still have to go somewhere else even if we went there.
These numbers include your overtime for the officers who are going?
Does.
They do. Okay.
This is an all-in cost.
This is
rental overtime.
Now saying it, it's very conservative numbers. So, and then finally, what's been mentioned a lot is the VSP facility in Blackstone. That is a wonderful facility in the making. My understanding is it was built with all asset forfeiture money from a significant drug company investigation. And currently, they have a nice academy building and a handful of driving tracks. There are no firearms facilities there right now. They're hopeful that they're going out for RFP December, January timeframe, and are hopeful, minus the state red tape, that something's built by the summer. Now, what they're intending to build are three outdoor ranges, shorter distances than what we have. So they're very similar in what we're proposing, but are not huge enough to accommodate the entire VSP contingent. And what that means is that facility is designed to be entry-level training and special schools. The organization of the Virginia State Police is divisions around the state. Each of those divisions have a place to shoot within their division. So they're not even going to travel to this facility. The only ones that will use this facility are the ones that are in the division where this facility is, and then their entry level, and then any special schools. So the division in, I'll just pick a place, Southwest Virginia, way down at the tip, will have a range down there, and that's where they will do most of their firearms training. They may come up here for up to Blackstone for some regional or some enhanced training, but the lion's share of their training is going to be at their division.
Where is Blackstone? Is that the Nottoway County thing
right.
that people have mentioned? And
that's right.
South on 288, something like that?
Yes, Fort Pickett area.
Which is that's way beyond an hour and a half.
In your figures that you're coming up with, does that include the specialized training for SWAT teams and special training?
It does not. It only
so
includes,
you still have to come up with some way to do that.
Well, it would be additional money to travel to these locations. All of these locations can accommodate that specialized training, but it's not included in this pricing. This is just the average officer going three times a year. So the travel cost associated with Blackstone is in the area of $58,800 annually.
So if you were to pick one of these options, if you were to say, well, looking at these facilities, the best option for us, given all the circumstances, if we were to not build a facility, which one would you pick?
I think you would have to pick multiple ones because you couldn't guarantee the time that's available that you, when you need it. Weather impacts, do we want to, storms coming, do we want to travel to Blackstone or do we want to go to Augusta? Well, let's call Augusta, see if they have time. Sorry, we don't have any time. Let's call Harrisonburg. Nope. The regional academy is training at Harrisonburg. So there's not one that can accommodate us, let alone the region.
I guess I'm not – you wouldn't normally schedule these things in advance?
You do, but so does everybody else. And if they're opening their doors to us, they're opening their doors to a lot of other people. So it's a first-come, first-serve type.
I understood, but I thought you said the Augusta, for example, $500 per day, unlimited number of officers. You figured maybe you'd have 15 to 20 people that would go over at a time, is what I understood you to say. Wouldn't you typically just call up and say, well, on 2 months from now, on Tuesday, whatever, we want to bring 15 officers over and try to schedule a time, get the slot?
Yeah, with Augusta and with a number of these ranges, you have to get things in place, liability agreements, use agreements, things like that ahead of time. And then they ask for you to predict your time. So, for example, we needed to do some training for our firearms group. I contacted Augusta, the person in charge of it, and I said, this is in early October. Can you give me your available dates for November? He's like, yeah, sure. Got an email back. It was like 7 days out of November, the range was available. We may or may not be able to work with that. And when you're at another person's beck and call, it's really hard to do effective training. That's the bottom line, and that's why we have outgrown Rivanna. We'd be trading the same scenario at Rivanna with scheduling conflicts for yet another facility that we have to pay for and travel to. It's hard for us to wrap our head around traveling for firearms training.
This might not be a fair question for you, maybe I need to ask Chief Longo, but if we did decide to travel in Albemarle County, what does that do for regional training together and events like that? I mean,
Rob's opinion, it would probably kill it. But
I would think too, because it'd be tough to coordinate between the two departments.
Wrapping my head around the time on this. Okay, if you typically you're training one, each officer's training once per year.
4 hours.
For 4 hours. And that's what we're talking about doing is saying, well, we want to go three. So we would be tripling the training, whatever option we chose here. Even if we were looking at going to Augusta and Harrisonburg, et cetera, I think that we ought to, as an operational expense, conclude that we need to do more training than we're presently doing, right? So if you're talking about, in addition to that, interjurisdictional training, how often would interjurisdictional training take place on top of that? I mean, I would think they're two different things. One is you're taking people over to qualify, but, I mean, you're talking about once or twice a year?
Well, it's hard to say because it's never been done.
Right. Well, if you did it twice a year, it'd be two more times than we're doing it now, correct?
Let me answer that for you real quickly. I mean, sort of our vision is to overlap some of those training days together and work together. There may be opportunities where we'll be able to throw a fourth day a year in there, but we certainly have a vision of try to combine our forces at least once a year to do some overlap. So I don't see any significant additional overlap. Does that answer your question, Dan?
It does. So you're talking about maybe once a year.
Yeah, maybe okay. More than that. We need to train with the fire department, too, and Chief Eggleston will talk about that briefly. You want to add anything, Tim?
I guess the only thing I would add is, as has been said before, we've never had the opportunity to do this. So to stand in front of you now and describe what it would look like, I don't know that we can. But to have the opportunity at any given time to have a place that we can converge on and say, okay, this is what we're going to do today. And far beyond just firearms training, as you've indicated before, we're looking ahead 10 years to, you know, we're asked all the time, how can you do things more efficiently, city and county? This is the golden opportunity to do it more efficiently and demonstrate that it can be done, not just with the police department, but with their fire service, with EMS, with every other public safety component that serves this community. This is just a tremendous opportunity. Wish we could describe it maybe a year from now when it comes to fruition. We'll be able to talk about some of the models we've been able to introduce and how effective it's been for our organizations.
Mention one four-hour training time per year becoming 3-4 hour. Now, is all of that shooting time, or is that combination classroom time and doing strategic stuff, and also a smaller part of it being shooting time?
Yes, it's all of it. You know, you get there, you get organized, you have a safety briefing, you do a little instruction, and then you move into the shooting. So the reason we're at 4 hours now, and we call that one time a year because that's one time a year the officer's going, is so that the 400 regional officers that are using Rivanna can get there and simply qualify. So we run one group of four people in the one group of 4 hour folks in the morning, a second group of 4 hour folks in the afternoon. So, but each of them are getting one trip to the range, and it's a little misleading, but it's actually only 4 hours. Where, you know, in the late 90s, everybody was shooting three times a year because we had less issues with capacity at Rivanna. The last point I want to make about traveling to a facility is the training liability associated with not being able to go when you need to go. You can only go when you can go. So if we're on the range and we're doing annual qualification and we've got six or eight, nine people who just aren't there yet, we can't let them go a couple of weeks to a month before they can go back to the range. We need to get them right back to the range for remedial training. So it's not good practice for us as instructors, let alone the department or the county, to accept the risk associated with someone that can't shoot for the period of time until you can get availability on at another facility and where that facility may be. So here at Rivanna, if we have somebody that's trouble shooting, we work with them either that afternoon immediately, or we come back the very next day one-on-one and do that, because we still have a good relationship with Rivanna that they allow us, you know, for two people to come down and work on some skills. We can't do that if we're traveling to Nottoway.
But you could continue to work with Rivanna on that basis, couldn't you?
Maybe.
For some reason why, if you did not go there, I mean, I understand that they really don't want you there all the period of time that you're taking now, that you, in fact, you would like more use of it than you can make right now because they have other uses. But there's no reason why you wouldn't be able to, you know, once a month call up and say, we've got somebody we want to take over and work with for 2 hours this week. Can we get a slot over there?
Well,
I guess what I'm trying to get at is what I don't want to, I mean, I think this is an important thing. Don't get me wrong. But when we start talking about $25,000 a year of expense to do it another way, and maybe it's not as good, and maybe it makes the difference worth it. But when you're talking about investing $1.3 million, and if you're going to do acoustic walls to deal with the sound issue, which may be a significant issue for people around there, then you're talking about 2.6 to 3 something million. The interest on that alone, you know, pays for training 10, 8 times over a year. So I think we need to think. I mean, I just want to make sure that we're probing all the options and understand the cost differentials and what the cost differential buys. And it may be worth it to buy that cost differential.
Well, if you were only looking at cost differentials for the training, I'm following your discussion, but you can't put a price on having your resources in the county available for emergency calls. You just can't put a price on that. So while this might look like a viable option, you know, training to training, it's certainly not a viable option if your TAC team is in Nottoway County and you have an active shooter at Albemarle High School. How do you deal with that?
And I can relate to that. On the other hand, if you go over to Augusta, you're not an hour and a half away.
If we can get Augusta.
There's no
guarantees.
Adam, I understand, Chair, but building your own facility provides the advantage of being able to go there anytime you want.
Right.
I guess, and that seems to be the primary difference between going to Augusta or someplace else and having your own facility. And there's an advantage to that.
Well, the primary
question is whether or not it's worth the cost difference, and it is a very significant cost difference.
Well, the primary advantage to having our own facility is to having the police department resources available to the public. That's the primary.
You could hire 10 officers, additional officers, for the additional cost per year, the additional annual cost of doing what we're talking about doing.
And those
that
10
would
officers,
make a whole lot of people available.
Madam Chair, I just would say our objective today was to lay out all of the different factors, some that are easy to quantify and others that are more difficult to quantify. And I think at the end of the day, we can give you more information if you need it, or you can use some judgment based on what you've heard, and we'll just need that direction from you. We do have a few more slides that I think will give the full picture, and I think it'll help us to get to the point where you all can see if you're ready to make a decision or if there's more we need to bring back.
That's good.
Yeah, last option that we talked about on that bullet for a second was the use of the Scottsville tire plant.
Brian, excuse me, we'd already communicated to the board on that, so I don't think we need, unless there's questions, I don't know if we need to go into further detail on that.
Financially, it does not look like a
Just real quick on project milestones, we've talked about some of these immediate ones, but bottom line is if we can keep on our path for the site plan resubmittal, you know, within the next month time frame, we should be able to continue through to a construction period next summer, and that's basically what the milestones are. The last slide, really, before Colonel Sellers concludes, is just quickly on the future phases. Dennis, you've had some questions on it. I think Dan maybe can address it, and appreciate everyone's patience. And this is a lot of details, a lot of information, a lot to digest, certainly, in an hour period, but we're almost at the end.
Well, I had good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board, but I can change that to good afternoon. So I think you heard throughout this presentation the importance of training for public safety, certainly. I hold that true for fire rescue. All of our jobs are very high risk, and we hold training very high in regards for our folks. So you know, it's extremely important that we provide good training for our firefighters and EMS personnel. You know, our volunteer program alone trains about 50 to 60 new volunteer firefighters a year. That's over 10,000 hours annually, certainly a huge workload. And much of this training occurs during nights and weekends. If you can imagine, go to any training event that we have for our volunteer academy, they're rushing from work to that classroom or the training center, oftentimes stopping to get fast food. That's how crunched of a time. So it makes it really difficult when we're talking about an off-site facility. Our current facility that we're using behind the regional jail is woefully inadequate, and it's important that we secure a site that'll fulfill our needs really in the long term and provide, you know, a good platform and a good site to train all of our people, both volunteer and career. And we believe this Keene site certainly provides the flexibility and for future expansion to add some of the things that we need. We're talking about in the future shared classrooms for our public safety folks, as well as some storage facilities. It's very important for us to have a fire training building, which would include advanced propane burn rooms that will help us address firefighter safety and help to reduce emissions, a vehicle extrication site to train our personnel in some of the advanced technologies we're seeing in terms of vehicle construction, such as hybrids and the metals that they're using in today's vehicles. In a spill mitigation site that we can train firefighters to adequately dam and divert any spills to help protect property and the environment. These are all very new in the fire service, and we certainly need to provide a site that we can adequately train our folks to take care of these kind of things. There's also space for a driving track. It's very important, as Colonel Sellers mentioned, to provide all of our public safety personnel adequate driver training to reduce our risk in the public, as well as provide safety for our officers and firefighters. So overall, we believe this site will accommodate our long-term needs and certainly will help us to continue to provide good focus and timely training for our volunteer and career personnel.
Are these pink and blue and red rectangles, are those some of those other training facilities you were talking about for fire?
Yes, these are just estimates of locations that would be on the site. But when I talk about the fire training building, what we envision is a prefabricated building that we would erect on site. Again, it uses some new technology to reduce any kind of emissions and noise and indoor smoke. But it's much more efficient, much more realistic for our firefighters, and so that's what we're looking at versus burning wood as we do today.
Couches.
And has anyone put an estimate on the cost of putting these facilities on the Keene site?
We have some cost in terms of those props to construct them. Very little site prep work would be involved. They are costs. They're not particularly in this budget. They would be in an out year that they're not in the CIP right now.
Do you have any idea, an estimate of the cost of ultimately having a facility that included these facilities you're talking about, including the driving track?
I can't recall the ultimate built-out cost of the center. It was estimated incrementally, but I don't recall those exact figures right now.
Trevor, have you have any of that? Or?
I was going to say, I think it's an important question and preliminary, but if we have something, I think a study was done several years ago that...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Tang study put a total build-out And I would caveat it by saying that the estimate was done really at the kind of peak of construction costs. For if everything were done, I think it's on the order of $20 million or so. I would suggest that the elements be looked at and that, you know, further refinement on both scope and cost be done before finalizing a number.
We're at a place in this where we had a broad concept, and we've worked it down to the specific things that have the greatest need, particularly because of the situation with Rivanna. And I think as we look at the future phases, we're talking conceptually about what we'd like to do, and we haven't gotten to the level of review that we need to do. And each one of those is going to have some decision points in them about whether they are best provided at this facility or we need to look at some other options. But conceptually, that was what we started this whole project with. One thing we didn't want to do today was to do a presentation just on a police firing range as if nothing else was being contemplated there.
I think it's important to look
at that. Yeah, and so we put it out there, also recognizing that we weren't going to have great answers for the ultimate cost of this or the decisions that we'll have to make along the way, including how we're cooperating with city fire and county fire and how we might work cooperatively on some best practices. So that's the place we're a little bit uncertain about in terms of total cost of this facility. But you all are going to have some of these things before you again. They haven't even gotten into the CIP yet, so the order of magnitude is difficult at this point. But it's a legitimate question, definitely. We did want to make sure that we said that something more might happen out there so the public didn't misunderstand that.
But the efficiency of having one roadway that can serve access to these multiple different features is something that's
a yeah, and I will say savings. To you that the value of what's before you is for a police firing range, whether we do it here or somewhere else. That's the real decision you have before you. And I think even if we do more out there or we never do anything else out there, I think you do have the information you need to make a decision on this. Some of those things are going to get weighed differently for sure.
I don't think, I mean, at present, I'm glad that we have some reasonable estimate of the cost of those facilities, because obviously that would be a very big decision, much bigger than the decision we're contemplating now. I don't think we can consider the advantages of what Dan's talking about in making the decision on whether or not this is a good decision to go forward with a firing range, because it is a totally separate decision, and we're not going to get the things he's talking about in this proposed $1.3 to $1.6 million phase.
I think the value of what you have before you today does not depend upon whether we can do the other things. So you can make this independent, I think.
It was just a
Chief, can you help me with – I'm just trying to understand how – because I can't visualize an example of how you might would have cross-training or training involving both fire rescue and police. I mean, I can understand traffic control and things like that, but –
Well, certainly one of the biggest initiatives we have right now is try to cross-train all public safety personnel in the use of incident command system. You take a vehicle accident, it involves both fire, EMS, and police, and how we interact as a unified team on the scene is very important in terms of how we manage that scene. So those are things that Colonel Sellers and I have been talking about, joint leadership training, and actually getting out there and working through simulations are extremely valuable to our folks.
Will we get the opportunity to do any of that with respect to phase one of this plan?
Yes.
Okay.
In the classroom building? Mm-hmm. And outside?
Well, outside.
And outside. I mean, the more it's important to understand the total benefits of the $1.6 million investment we're talking about here.
That's $800,000, remember, because it's
$800,000. Right. Communities.
To me, again, the advantages of this site is that it's local, it's within driving distance for our volunteers who have to attend classes at nights and weekends. Its site is big enough to accommodate future things that we talked about. So from that perspective alone, we think it's a huge advantage. The fact that we can train with our public safety folks and law enforcement on scene makes it tremendously valuable to us.
Thanks.
Chief Longo and I are going to wrap things up, okay, and we'll move on. Completion of this project will ensure our public safety employees have the highest level of training to improve our readiness to respond to critical incidents, lower the liability associated with high-risk incidents, and help us to better protect our community. It permits the public safety administrators here today to best live up to our responsibility to ensure our men and women have the best chance to return home safely to their loved ones. Embracing the long-term plan of consolidating our public safety training needs onto one campus and repurposing a landfill to provide a safer community just makes sense to us. This county-city partnership and multidisciplinary training facility allows departments to pool our resources to better afford technology, better instruction, and more diverse curriculums. A police firearms range is one small step toward making your police department and sheriff's departments better prepared to handle deadly encounters and active shooter incidents like experienced in Virginia Tech and most recently in Aurora, Colorado. Quite simply, regional, multidisciplinary, and integrated public safety training is the way of the future. It's more cost-effective than the alternatives, and it's more effective than our current model. Traveling outside our community to a facility controlled by another entity can jeopardize the safety of our citizens due to limited staffing and place undue restrictions in our ability to manage the scheduling of our resources and negatively impacts our overtime and gas expenditures. But even more importantly, an outside facility impedes our ability to train together as city and county police officers, firefighters, and rescue workers, thus moving in the opposite direction of lessons learned in past terror events and active shooter incidents. My partner in crime, Chief Longo, has a few final remarks.
And I will be brief. And let me thank you for your patience this morning, for listening to him. A lot of information. We can be very long-winded sometimes when we're trying to persuade you to do something that's difficult. I was encouraged, although there were differing opinions during the public comment section about where this should be done. I think everybody said it should be done somewhere and that what we do is important, and to train us to do it well for the protection of this community is extremely important. I think even those opposing this site would agree with that. I hate to see that my cops travel to go home every night, you know, sometimes 25 or 30 miles away. I wish they lived in the community that they served. I sure want them to train in the community that they serve, and certainly not an hour and a half from here. So I hope you'll make this investment not just in a piece of real estate so that we can train on it, but to make the investment in the guys and gals that we hire to do this work. It would be a strong message to them that we value what they do if we're willing to make this investment and give them the tools to train in a way that makes this the world-class community that I think it is. So, again, thank you for your time, and we really appreciate and look forward to your support.
Chief Longo, just out of curiosity, has the city council already approved this and put it in their budget?
Yes, sir. The council's embraced it. The manager embraces it. Mr. Watts embraces it. He watches the bottom line, and the department looks forward to it, quite frankly.
It is in their CIP.
Yes, sir.
It's in our CIP.
Yeah, I think your question was whether it's actually in the CIP, and it is.
Yes, thank you.
I still have just one question that's still not clear on. If you go to the ballistic baffles, they do not go on top of the existing 20-foot berm. They would be a baffle that you would place at ground level and go up a certain amount of feet.
That's correct. It's in replacement of the berm.
Okay, and how thick is that?
How thick?
Yeah.
Rob, do you have the...
And they absorb the bullets and everything, just like the earth would?
Sir, it's 24 inches in thickness.
How often does that have to be replaced?
I don't have any...
Well, we know about what the use is going to be.
Is the reinvestment every 10 years in the total cost, or just a refacing of... the surface? Or how
we would have to look at training slightly differently if we had the ballistic walls versus the berms. The tactical training we do or want to do, the proposed facility allows you to do that in a 180-degree area in the designated impact area of the range. The ballistic walls are a safety factor in case you happen to shoot them. They're not there intended to be shot.
So it's not
a replacement for the berm.
So you still have to have the berm.
It's a safety replacement.
Okay.
It's not a shooting replacement, I guess is a way to put it.
It would be the sidewalls, not...
But for training, they want to be able to use the sidewalls occasionally, and that's
why I'm trying to get clear on that.
That's right. We would be more static with those walls in place. Otherwise, you can certainly shoot into them as much as you want, but then you get the replacement cost.
How thick is the top of the berm?
5 feet. 5 feet. At 20 feet high.
5 feet to 40.
That's okay. Correct.
So there's really not room to plant anything up there. Just put your post in and everything for the baffle, for the eyebrow. Can that eyebrow be constructed out of a baffle material that would help? Would that help to reduce the sound?
There's soundproof matting that I've seen on eyebrows. There's a weatherization replacement cost to that because it's not weatherproof. But there are technologies that we could use to put on the face of that.
I was just curious as to the main thing I'm concerned about is the impact on the neighbors. I'm satisfied that all the safety precautions are being taken. I'm just concerned about what they might hear during the day and as they go about their normal life. So if the 20-foot berm did not mitigate the sound to what we expect, from what I'm hearing, there's no other range in this area with a 20-foot berm.
I've been to quite a few, and Henrico is about the closest, and it's not 20 feet everywhere.
Okay. And how close are they to residential areas?
I haven't measured it, but their closest residence, whether it's a resident or a commercial area, I would say is very similar to our closest ones.
Okay.
They're also adjacent to a racetrack, so there's a little more noise going on there at different times, but perhaps an environment that's more accustomed to high-intensity noise.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But the question, just to further the question on the baffle, that is something that could be added as a second stage inside the baffle that you would plan to construct to keep the rollovers from happening. In other words, another layer could be added on the inside if, after things happened and we found out what the real result was going to be. I mean, I would love to. I had a harebrained idea which didn't turn out to be very effective, which was to do some testing, but it was going to give all the wrong information anyway. So at least once the baffles were there, there would be something objectively to be able to test and then determine whether an interior layer could be added to the eyebrow.
That's correct. If the noise mitigating material isn't added in the first place, there's probably no harm in adding it in the beginning. It would just need to be built into the cost of the eyebrows.
Okay, so you could get back to us on what that extra layer would be from the beginning.
Yeah, I don't think it's anything huge.
Oh, all right. Just on the vertical and the roof.
If you're ever at the Milton range that UVA uses, mm-hmm. they have some of this material on their security fencing.
Okay. Try to keep the sound.
To try to keep sound, to try to absorb more sound.
Uh-huh. This is not a major cost
of course they
in the project.
That's really
I wouldn't.
Close.
Really. Close. We haven't quantify priced it, that. But yeah.
But they have a school close by there. What does it sound like up at the school, up at Woodbrook? Not Woodbrook.
I've never heard it when I've been teaching there, but that doesn't. I'm sure it's available. Somebody could tell.
Do they shoot there often?
The neighbors came in to one of our meetings recently and complained about the expanded shooting that was taking place over there because they do hear it and it bothers them.
And that's the university force. I think they're closer there than
across the river.
We're seeing here. Right. Mm-hmm. But they're
and they don't have a perm.
No. Lots of differences. Yeah,
right.
All kinds of differences. You'd have to really get all those, and you're not comparing apples to apples, I think.
I would love to know what that extra effort would cost.
Absolutely.
Reassure us. Thank you.
Chair, I got a thought I would like to put out
please,
if I could.
Share your thought.
I had the opportunity recently to attend a dinner where Colonel Sellers was the speaker, and one of the things he took the people through there was, did you know? And his comments were, did you know that we have the least number of officers per capita of any county in the state? A number of other ones. And I think he was surprised when I kept raising my hand because I said, yeah, I did know that. Not many people did. The point I'm trying to make is this. We've been handicapped in our police department for a long time. We know we have. We're underfunding in terms of officers. any approach, and I, and first of all, I empathize with the neighbors down there. I certainly do, and I understand that this is going to be an unpleasant situation for them, and no matter what we do, and I think there's a great deal being done to mitigate the impact of this facility, but we've taken a Band-Aid approach to this for a long time. I mean, we sort of take a Band-Aid approach, and I think trying to make them travel somewhere, not be able to work regionally and things like that is just another Band-Aid approach, and I, for one, am not willing to do that. And so I'm prepared today to either, by motion or consensus, however you want to do it, to give them the reinforcement they need to move forward with this project. And if that needs to be in the form of a motion, I'll be glad to do it.
That's one other question I wanted to ask. The lady that was shot in the car just north of here, what did lack of training contribute to that incident?
Yeah, I can't answer that question. I don't know if any of my counterparts can. No.
Thank you.
I had probably the most questions about
that's
this.
That's been the biggest thing in our minds ever since that happened.
Primarily, I wanted to make certain that we were looking at all the options because this is a big investment. And what are the benefits we would acquire for this investment? Also, I think the neighbors have raised a number of issues that some of which I think still need to be addressed. I am impressed with the amount of public participation that the police department has invited on this project, the availability to which they have made themselves to the neighbors to talk about this, ways that might mitigate any problems that would arise from this. The idea of using off-site facilities, while I'm convinced it would be less expensive, I think the trade-off would probably not be a good one. And I think that we tentatively made a decision in the CIP to move forward with this before. A lot of information has come up in the interim. I want to make certain that we explored every possibility. I think we have, at this point, done that. I'm prepared to continue to support the project. That would be subject to one thing and two things. One is I don't think we should be making a decision that we are going to make this available beyond the local police forces, Charlottesville, Albemarle, and perhaps the university, if necessary.
Sheriff in jail.
Right, yeah. Right. In the sense, because I think to do that expands the impacts, expands the concerns of neighbors, and I think that any decision to expand the use beyond what we're talking about today ought to be something we take up thoughtfully with consideration for them. So I think we should only be talking about the uses that we have had put before us here today. Second, I think if there are ways that we can explore to reduce noise impacts, even if there's some significant cost involved, I think we should consider that. Because when we're talking about, two shots per minute throughout the day. Now, I understand we're not going to be shooting all the time every day, but that's kind of the average. If you look at the number of shots being fired that we expect being fired based on our internal use, we're talking about two shots per minute over a 10-hour day. And that we need to find, and I think once it's set up, we need to test the noise around the sites, and we need to look for ways to minimize that impact. I don't think we should make certain, and I think that thus far it appears we've done a good job of doing this, that any potential for stray shots we have minimized to the maximum extent possible. Also, we need to make certain that the city is in this. I understand the chief said they've included it in their budget, but if we determine that we need some additional noise mitigation, there's a cost of that. I would hope that they would share in that cost. Thank you.
But do you think we need a motion on this effect, or would you prefer to have a motion or just a consensus?
Your support of the proposal. The only thing that I hear that's any different is whether or not we might do anything else to mitigate the noise. And
I think that what I've heard today and what I've heard from both sides of this issue, from the neighbors and from our departments, is that they're sitting down and they're talking about these things and they're talking through these issues. And I think what I'm hearing from this board, and I agree with Dennis, is that we're willing to put up some extra money for some additional soundproofing or some additional safety issues. we'd like you to keep working on those issues and come back to us if you need some more money to
That's the one thing that we'll do some extra work on. I think the rest of it, maybe what we can do is to outline or just give you a document that says, here's how we're going to do this. It won't be much more than what you saw in the presentations, but it'll be a little bit more certain. There are certain hours, as an example, that we won't do it, those types of things. I think we can put that together, and the one thing we'd come back to you is, here's how much more you can spend and the value you'll get out of that, because we want you to understand that some of these things are really not going to make much of a difference to the neighbors that are going to hear this noise if it's two shots every minute or whatever those things are. But there may be some, we want to explore that fully, that they have some value. So that's the main thing I think we need to bring back to you.
But I think it's an excellent point, because hearing the noise, I'm going through it with Rockydale Quarry. What testing would you suggest, Dennis, that they would do to determine the noise level?
We'd be able to test with it.
Yeah, that's
absolutely.
I think we need to understand what the noise impacts are with respect to the facility once it's built, and then be prepared, if needed, to spend some additional money to mitigate that impact.
Madam Chair, what we have is project is moving forward basically as proposed. We'll come back with some more of that information, and we'll do some documentation and.
I'd like to make a motion to that effect, too, so that we can
get... I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I'd like to move that we reaffirm our prior decision to move forward with the training facility, and that we encourage and, in fact, ask the departments to work with the neighbors to make sure any further mitigation we might do.
Would you add to that the no outside use...
Yeah, I can add that.
That wasn't proposed sure.
Unless,
right
unless
now,
we
anyway.
Specifically approve it at
yeah,
some
without, without date. Approval of the board.
Right.
Did you get that?
And second the motion.
Okay.
I was just very impressed with the committee work that you're already setting up to go forward. That's very important.
Mr. Snow?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Mr. Boyd?
Yes.
Mr. Dumler?
Madam Clerk, I abstain.
Ms. Malik?
Yes.
Mr. Rooker?
Yes.
I do want to, Madam Chair, really thank our police department, fire, all of our folks, public safety folks. They have put a lot of time in it. It is a model for communication and interaction with the community. It doesn't always work out where everybody's 100% agreement, but there's been a tremendous amount of hours, and I wanted to thank all of our staff and the city and all the other folks involved in this, because it's been a significant effort.
And I think very responsive to the public. Well. I think that's really the performance bar we need to see going forward, too.
Well, good presentation. And the fact that it's being shared with the city obviously reduces the financial impact, and that's greatly appreciated.
I didn't mean to leave out our OFD staff, because they've carried it through the whole time. So.
Thank you very much. We have... Let's see, Dan's here. Okay, we're going ahead with fire and rescue. Now.
We are going to reschedule the overtime.
That's put off till next month. That's right.
Until December.
So we're doing CACVB because they're all still here. Okay.
That's the only thing before lunch.
All right.
How's that?
Item 15.
I heard that. All right. As our consultant staff is getting ready for the presentation, just want to take a minute to tell you that we're very excited to be before you today with the next phase of our tourism marketing program. As you probably remember, when we presented the marketing plan itself several months ago, it was really based on the understanding that we needed to refresh the brand that we have for our tourism destination, that we really needed to make sure it was dynamic, engaging, that it reflected the traditional assets that have always had a strong appeal for our community, and also incorporated some of the new and emerging tourism activities and attractions that we have here, whether it's agritourism, the food scene, the music scene, those kinds of things, to make sure that we were really putting up the broad spectrum of what Charlottesville, Albemarle County is all about. So we're here today to present this material to you. What you're about to see has been reviewed and endorsed by the CACVB Executive Board and also by City Council on Monday night. So what we're hoping is, after you have an opportunity to see the presentation, that you will be able to provide your endorsement as well to this tourism direction. I want to really express appreciation to the CACVB staff who's worked hard on this, and obviously to our consultant partner, Payne Ross Associates, who's done a tremendous job for us. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Susan Payne.
Thank you very much, Lee. We are happy to be back today to present the logo, the refreshed logo, to you. What you will see is the logo, and then we have put it in context. We have not finished the ads, etc., but you will see how the logo could be used. Technical moment. Are you gonna do it? Oh, there you are. Okay. When we were here, what's going on here? When we were here with you last time, we expressed our goal of more people staying longer, spending more. Since that time, we have evaluated what our product is with much research and determined that our product is the Charlottesville and Albemarle County is a place treasured by all who have visited, worked, learned, lived, or fallen in love here. It is a place with a thriving economy thanks in large part to the intellectual engine that is the University of Virginia, which brings in and attracts smart people with big ideas. It is a place filled with world-class cultural events and extremely convenient leisure activities. People of all kinds, artists, professors, farmers, and musicians know how to live well and live healthfully in Charlottesville and Albemarle County. We have conducted many focus groups over the past several months. We have distributed online surveys to thousands of people. We have met with stakeholders in the tourism industry in this area, and we have audited existing research from the Virginia Tourism Corporation. The point of this is to let you know that we have, from the ground up, involved as many people as possible in this process to come up with our new logo. Some of our findings, which are interesting from our research, is that our primary market are people in Washington, D.C. and Virginia, that they're going for an extended weekend and are traveling by car, and the majority of our visitors are between 30 and 50 years old with higher education and many with children. We are looking at a $490 million revenue generator in this area, Charlottesville and Albemarle, an industry that supports 5,000 jobs and in the past year generated $35 million in state and local taxes for Charlottesville, Albemarle. We have, after the synopsis of, you will, of all our research and all our focus groups, etc., the brand has boiled down to the fact that Charlottesville and Albemarle County brand is an easy access getaway where the juxtaposition of history, tradition, and energy and innovation make a unique and unforgettable destination. The unique promise is that a visitor need not leave the area to enjoy this eclectic mix of traditions and innovations. One can enjoy great food, wine trails, shopping, skiing, hiking, biking, live music, historical sites, and more, all within our region and at their own pace and their own itinerary. Now I would like to ask Jamie Howard, our creative director, to come forward.
Okay, so we're going to sort of take you through some of the creative here and sort of tell you where I think we've been waiting to get to for a while so we can brand this area and get a few more people in here and hopefully get a couple more dollars in here. This line is the line we currently have, and it sort of plays off two key things. We discovered in research that history kind of played a big part. You know, we kind of surveyed, and that kind of ended up being, as being sort of one of the drivers, one of the leaders in what we found. And so as we sort of dug deeper into that, we also found that people always wanted to sort of this idea of discovery. So as over time, we sort of combine those two ideas into this idea, which is sort of uniquely Charlottesville. It's not like you are going off to, you know, pardon the phrase, a moldy, oldie, historical place that just is frozen in time. Charlottesville is sort of its own unique way. It's sort of, we have history, but it's not just something that is locked. It's sort of, we're refurbishing it, we're renovating it, and we're sort of making our own as we go. And so this line is sort of where tradition is always new, speaks to not only the tourist, but also the area. And we think that's something that's an action that they'll make their own traditions, and also they'll discover our approach as we go. I think I have some reasonable control over this thing. Oh, look at that. There we go. This is the new logo that we have created for you. And Vicky's going to come up and talk a little bit about it, because there's a lot of things going on in this logo. There's a lot of reasons behind this logo. I'll let Vicky start in for a moment here.
I get the fun part, the picture. As Jamie was saying before, yeah, the overwhelming majority of reasons for people coming here is the history idea. But not to lose sight of our brand promise, which talks about that juxtaposition of history and innovation, we've basically created a more modern approach to a Jeffersonian piece of architecture, and that's what you're looking at. It's a modern icon or a modern twist on something very historic and Jeffersonian. And we've taken it and set it atop the word Charlottesville, and we've varied the letter heights and created basically a landscape. It could be a mountain landscape or an urban cityscape. Something else that when we were doing these focus groups and online surveys, people said, you know, this area is noted for its beauty, and we didn't want to let that go in our logo. We set it atop Albemarle County, Virginia, again, taking advantage of that opportunity to subtly reinforce that juxtaposition of city and county. And also, we know that when tourists look for destinations, they look regionally. And using Albemarle County, Virginia, we've really, really opened up our brand, our offerings, and just it's a much wider region, a much, much wider opportunity to get tourists. And I guess, as Lee probably already mentioned, this was presented to the Tourism Board and approved, and so this is our recommendation to you.
I think you could have made the Albemarle the larger type and the Charlottesville the
same thing.
Yeah, that was my thought too, was, gee, we're small. I mean, after 10 years, we're there, which is a step in the right direction, but we're still small. We're still too small.
I think visually, you don't, I mean, if you made it much larger, it would extend out beyond the margin.
You don't have to have all the words. You just put Albemarle instead of Albemarle County, Virginia. Okay. You know, we're stewing the pot here, stirring the pot when it may not be the role, but...
Well, I think, you
I think this
have,
was a compromise between recognizing that Charlottesville is has been the brand for a long time. It is kind of, people recognize city names whether we like that or not. That's kind of the reality. But bringing Albemarle County into it, and there was a real conscious choice to put the word county because it does play against that. You've got city offerings and county offerings. So it was kind of trying to bring both sides of the juxtaposition together in there. You know, it's hard to have equal competition between Charlottesville and Albemarle County without
I was halfway kidding with my remark there, but
I wasn't kidding.
I know you weren't. But what I really was, the point that comes to mind is that if you think about it in terms of the wine industry, which is what is a great attraction for us these days, people don't think of Charlottesville as the wine country. They think of Albemarle County as the wine country. So.
Have it on the cover sheet of the website are our pictures. They're not the city pictures. So we've been dissed for a long time here.
Your logo of the rotunda is sort of a cross between Montpelier.
Right. More, we just, and, exactly. Our cues were Jeffersonian architecture.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I like the logo, personally. I think it's, like anything, I think you need to look at it and study it for a few minutes and let it kind of
Again, as Susan was mentioning, we'll take you through. Basically, we haven't finished the creative. We wanted to give you a sneak peek. We're just scratching the surface here, but to let you see how it looks in context, and then, you know, maybe revisit the conversation we were just having about the size. But shall we move forward right now and then?
One more question. Oh. Is the rotunda going to be gold or yellow or what?
Yes, we as far as colors go, we did some color studies, and The gold is kind of a neoclassic color.
Oil stamp it on certain things.
Oh, certainly, certainly. Just it's gold. Yes, it's neoclassic color. It's yellow is a very happy color. And we have paired it with gray, and gray is a traditional color, but the combination of gray and yellow is a very contemporary duo, and so, yeah, the golds are recommend. We also are showing you today a couple of other layout options, because with the way media is, you've got mobile web, mobile apps, pens, I mean, T-shirts, hats, there's so many different application opportunities. And so out of the gate, we wanted to offer a seal version. The center one's a more traditional vertical version, and the one on the far is, I guess, a little more horizontal. So if you had to squeeze it onto a pin or a web banner ad. Below you'll see we've offered a couple more color options to round out the palette. We've got a blue for the Blue Ridge, a Merlot for Wine Country, and taken together, it's a nice combination, and it's also a nod to the seasons with summer and spring being yellow, winter blue, and fall the Merlot color.
Also, it's not an easy word to fit into a lot of artwork. I know my company, Charlottesville Press, so we really struggle sometimes with.
It's a tough one.
It looks great, though.
Yeah. Thank
Looks
you.
Great.
I love the tagline.
Yeah. And let's see. I'm going to go show you just one of the pieces of application. We're not going to call it an ad. We're basically an opportunity to show you how the logo might work because, as you were saying, yeah, Charlottesville is a tough one. And even having the whole thing Charlottesville, Albemarle County, Virginia, very, very important that everything be visible. And this particular execution, you can see everything very, very well. We wanted to say one thing about the photography style we're presenting right now. This is something else that we focus grouped. We showed just landscape photos. We showed more testimonial style photos. And with our focus groups, this is something that really resonated. It's more of a authentic, it's dynamic, and making sure that this is King family, making sure that the destination is obvious. And so this is the photography direction that our focus groups led us in.
It was fantastic.
Very, very energetic, very
it's
fun.
A lot to
Lively
it.
And energetic is a couple words that kept coming up at our focus groups, and so we wanted to make sure that we captured that.
Is there a slide where you've incorporated the wine color?
Oh, not yet. Not yet.
Once again, this is Albemarle County picture, right?
Right. I mean, I think if, for example, in a shot like that,
in county,
if you
right?
had if yes. you had the Albemarle County, Virginia thing in the wine, as opposed to a gray, to me, it'd be much more attractive. But that's just me.
Yeah, and actually, that was something we talked about doing, is kind of having the wine color. For specific, and that's why that was how the genesis of how that came to be. Yeah, I know Anne's still percolating about the hierarchy, but we do need to create a hierarchy when we do these things. And we sort of thought of a lot of times people say I'm going to Charlotte, so even though they mean 50-100 square mile area. And so anyway, that's where we began. And sort of artistically, we knew if it was 1-to-1, it would look sort of like a block. But we can come back to that. We can spend a few hours on that. In a
Not
little
today.
While, yeah. Just kidding. Okay.
I mean, I think if you use color to distinguish
yes.
the Albemarle County component, I think you could do that. You wouldn't need to change the size.
And it wouldn't take much. I mean, a little shrink of Charlottesville and a little increase of Albemarle, even though Albemarle's smaller, but with a different color, would solve my problem. And I know you can do it because you're a smart boy.
I'm going to take it under advisement. I think that's what they say in political circles. Let's see, I'm going to try this clicker and go a little further. So basically what you have here is we just wanted to show you how the logo operates on the picture. And for right now we have the tagline. That's not really a headline, but for those who are familiar with marketing, that would be more of a tagline. But we just wanted to show you how it worked. And so we've really searched for authentic moments, but then we really take the time to shoot them really well. And I think people will pick that up. I think it'll, rather than getting a model and having pretend to cook in a pretend place and pretend clothes, find it, but then really get someone who's a really good photographer to bring it to life. And so in this one, it was feast, where tradition is always new. This one is love, where tradition is always new. And let's see, let's go forward here a little bit, and you'll see play. There's Monticello. And the idea is just because you show historic landmark, everyone's seen Monticello a million times, but why not sort of bring in the the mood of this piece, which is, it's yes, there's Monticello, but then there's that sort of joie de vivre, and there's that sort of life that is Charlottesville. It's not just tradition. There's something a little more. It doesn't necessarily have to be this shot. I think that's Kenneth and Rodney, but I can't tell who that is. But anyway, so we'll go a little further here, and this is Stroll, where tradition is always new, and this is kind of a fun shot downtown. And again, you sort of see a similar theme in the way these are shot.
One thing, I mean, throughout these, every time it shows up, I do not like the gray. I do not like the use of gray, Albemarle County, Virginia.
It looks faded.
I almost can't read it.
Can you go back? Oh, there it is. You're talking about the letters. Gotcha.
About the letters of Albemarle on all these pictures.
Gotcha.
Letters, you've got the letters for Albemarle County, Virginia in gray.
They're actually white, but it's a tough the projector.
White is the Charlottesville. They're different.
It's actually what's happening is it's smaller, so it looks gray.
One looks bold, and the other one looks regular. So
yeah.
See, it's just
it's a little bit like bringing a Dallas Cowboy jersey to a Redskin meeting. I know it's a little bit of a challenge to bring this in here, but
it look gray.
Yeah.
Reduce the size of it, and I just think if you use the wine or some other color there, it would bring out. It would be more readable and more noticeable.
You're saying it make Albemarle County wine colored?
Depends on what the
background. That could disappear
is.
Though into the background. But we should, you know, I think the key is that it's
I think what we're hearing is that you're concerned about
yes.
the visibility, and
yes.
that's something
visibility.
That we can
gotcha.
Certainly
we will
address. Here's to be an afterthought here. To me.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, let's stick them in there. Yeah.
It's smaller, and then the color changes, and it becomes gray.
Gotcha. Here it is in web form, and you see the this would be a print ad. This is a wedding destination. Love or tradition is always new. I think this was you know what venue this was, anybody? King Family again, and you'd have the logo. This could also be a video, and one of the sort of the main drivers on our end is to create a lot of video content to really bring the product to life, because we've found that when people, since so many of the decisions are made on the internet, that we really want to have something they can click and suddenly have it kind of come to life in sort of other senses, you know, sight, sound. So this could also be a video grab that they could click on quickly and find. And so we're really going to be really strategic where we put all these videos, so people will constantly be discovering us and where their particular affinity is. This is it in a phone app. And just sort of seeing it sort of applied and how it would look. This would be possibly you could put it on YouTube. This would be a still from a fall or wine-focused film. And we probably would have this in many other places as well.
I'll remove it.
This is video, so we couldn't probably Photoshop that out. But I can... have somebody make stand in the background and point at it and say,
"There you go."
Well, that's Whitehall. That's where that's
But yeah, good eye. But this was taken out at I think Whitehall Vineyards at sunset. And there you are. This would be here. You are in the Charlottesville Airport. This would be the video playing. Also at the airport or some other, could be, you know, visitor center, airport.
Station.
Yeah, exactly. Train station, Anne's Kitchen, who knows where. Anywhere you want to play it. This would be another.
Glad you got the race. That's.
Yeah. We've been running around trying to get a lot of different things. This was at Fox Field, another possible headline that might go in there. And then I think we're going to talk a little bit about the local brand alliances. And I can talk about it. Susan, I can hear a chair coming. She's going to talk about this right away.
Thank you. We all know that our area is getting well known for the different festivals that we have here, whether they're film festivals, book festivals. And this one happens to be an example using the photography festival. And what we want to do is promote collaboration. So events that are happening will not just carry their own branding, since the city and county are helping to sponsor these events, but we will cross-promote.
so that they are all integrated together. Hopefully, the Virginia Tourism site has millions of visitors, a million per month. We will feature our event on their site, which will then click away to the tourism site, which might cross-promote a vineyard or an overnight stay, and then it will also bring us back to the particular festival website. The idea is, again, that we want people spending one more night, and if they're coming here for an artist fair or a book festival, we want them to know that they should plan an extra evening.
Do you know whether or not the domain of visitalbumwell.org is available?
Let me look. I don't know that.
I think that
find out
right
here. Mm-hmm. Find out. We could add that if we had a particular wine weekend. Likewise, if we had...
Well, I'm just thinking about people, about mm-hmm. driving people to this site if they type in Albemarle.
Right. That's a good idea. And what we can do is buy both and point them at each other so that we'll get more credit that way.
We do already have that. We domain, do have by that. The way, and it points to
Wonderful.
The CACVB website.
Great. So we can use that, and if there are festivals in the county, then we should, you know, work with them in collaboration, with the end result being more people staying longer, spending more. This is a fun part that we're worked on, and I'm going to let Jamie come back and
take this away.
When you Google it, it goes it to the right.
She can manage that.
So, yeah, we'll endeavor to get that URL linked to whatever URL you wish, or even create it. We've been shooting a little bit, and so we just kind of wanted to give you a rough idea of what we've been up to. And we are still... We have a lot more to do in terms of also just even the faces. We want to make sure we've given attention to diversity, ages, sort of a range of demographics. But, you know, we're trying to cover everything. But the thing that's come first is just at least trying to, before all the leaves are gone, trying to get a record of what goes on here in the fall. So this is sort of a quick record of that. We've sort of used a local musician for the background music. And I will try to get this to do something that hopefully, let's see how this works here. It's coming from over here. Nobody panic.
Place you'd want to live.
Yeah. So that's a quick look at what we've been up to. We thought we should bring it today, even though nothing's been, you know, in its targeted finished form, just so you guys can see what we've been doing here.
Very nice.
Very exciting stuff. It's grand.
Okay, we are ready to take any questions. I know we are all that stands between us and your lunch, as they say. So
this is our opportunity to make sure that we hang on to the string long enough to get those final letters. You know, let's not let it go for another.
Right. So today, what we're looking at, we know there'll be changes and input on the ads and videos, etc. Today, what we wanted you all to focus on was looking at the logo.
I think what you're hearing from us is that we'd like to see Albemarle a little more prominent somehow, whether that's
We've
by
got
color,
that.
Whether that's by
some creative.
Especially when you do look at the website things and the pictures, you can't read.
Well, I'm sure, I must tell you that this is rough. We will assure you that we would not do an ad that you couldn't read. I mean, I think we're a little stuck here with the equipment that we have. So I apologize that it isn't as clear as it should be. But we would not do something that wasn't visible. I think that what we've done, and just to speak to that again, Anne, we have listened and studied and decided the county is important to put with Albemarle, so that we can extend our brand reach by offering, as you suggest, the wine and the food. That comes across clearer when we couple it with Albemarle County. And Charlottesville Albemarle, to some people that we focus grouped, they weren't sure what that was. It's like, what is Albemarle? Do you know? So we felt it was more important to put Albemarle County VA so that people got, that we had the juxtaposition of the city and the county, which extended our offerings, which we hope, again, would extend the stay.
I mean, I think it's done in an appropriate way if you can find
a way to make it bigger.
You can use color.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the wine thing, which really went to the color. In other words, if in the logos you could perhaps have Albemarle County in the wine color or something like that.
We can try it and show it to people or make it bigger.
So it stands out a little bit, even though it may not be as large.
Welcome to send it around to us by email. We'll be happy to.
Okay, we can certainly do that.
The overall look of the logo is great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dwayne.
The video that goes with it, I think it's perfect.
I agree.
Thank you.
I think we're basically hoping to get from you today is your endorsement of the direction that we're going with the tagline and the logo,
like the
brand message, the brand promise, kind of the energy and the direction that that's going in. And what we're hearing clearly is the looking at the Charlottesville Albemarle, understanding there's a hierarchy, as they explained, but making sure that Albemarle County is a strong player in the brand and how it's treated in ads and those kinds of things as it moves forward. Is that capture what
we'll
we're, your direction?
The cross-branding you mentioned about the festivals is really important, too, because of the public dollars and the tourist dollars that are going into them, and they need to understand that's their expectation, is that they will put that link on there, not, oh, maybe, but...
I think we have to work harder on that collaboration. Mm-hmm. Because
it's very one-sided right now. It's sort of a one-direction thing, and we need it to be two-direction.
And I think it's to our advantage, by the way, because hopefully with the videos that we're doing, we're going to be doing 10 or more of these videos. And all the things that we will be doing, at the end of the day, we want people to know whenever they come here that there's something to do. If you think of Charleston, for instance, or Austin, you know there's something happening. So we want to keep enough festivals and energy and music and everything out there so that it'll come across, if you live in Northern Virginia, that this is a quick and easy gateway. You can get here and spend 3 days.
Susan, you know, I'm sure you're aware that the Piedmont Council of the Arts has done a recent survey to indicate how much they bring to the community. I didn't see anything incorporating the arts in there. I'm sure you've got it somewhere.
We will do that. And I think in the arts that we're referring to, we're also, you know, just stepping out with, you know, Paramount, which is the film festival. Again, the performing arts, the visual arts, whatever. So we're trying to... Love to hear all those comments, because what we want to do is get all this and all these videos so people will begin to understand this area a little bit better. And we thought you'd like the kayaks.
Absolutely.
Huh?
That was great. Love the kayaks. I mean, we have scenic rivers here that
I know.
Need to get people,
and people
onto
don't know
instead
that.
Of driving to West Virginia.
And it's
to
so
float
unique
the river.
That Albemarle County touches the Shenandoah National Park. I'm not sure that a lot of know that, and if you're sitting in Washington, D.C., that's probably a good thing to know.
There may be a road sign somewhere where you can show Whitehall and the park is 6 miles up the
hill
or something that you can throw into
take a hike.
And the other thing that crossed my mind when you mentioned that in the surveys and the stakeholder groups, many people associate it by coming by car. So maybe having something in the video about the train coming here would let all those, especially international visitors in D.C. who don't want to bother with cars, absolutely, will know that there is that easy train link to get down here.
Yeah, and we have some more work to do on that. I'd like to work with our CACVB and look at our product a little bit closer. I mean, how do you get from the train station to Monticello? If you take a train here, is there easy rental? I mean, what am I doing? So I think, how do I get a kayak? Or these sorts of questions. Is there a place to sign up for the wine tour? Is that perhaps packaged with the train and then I can do this? I think we have some more product work to do.
There's some, definitely some gaps, the chauffeur groups, the tour buses.
But it's not, I think there's some work to do. Lee, do you
I think that's all part of how we're moving forward.
Right.
I mean, I think this is a great first step, and I think the plan is that in January or so, you will start to see this really rolling out in buys and, you know, the kinds of things where it'll be very visible to you. But it's exciting to get this far, and again, I really want to thank CACVB staff and Payne Ross for getting us to this point. Thank you.
I just had one other suggestion. Mm-hmm. You might look to make sure you're including various ethnicities.
Yes, you're exactly right, and that's you're exactly right.
What we noticed that,
yeah, basically, and I just would I'm going to say it one more time. We wanted to show you the logo for your general buy-in on the logo. We're far away from being finished with the other pieces. But thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see. Where are we? We're postponing 13 and 14. Let me check those off there and there. No, that's gone.
We've got a closed meeting.
So we are ready, I think, for Chris.
All right. Madam Chair, at this time, I move that the board go into a closed meeting pursuant to Section 2.2-3711-alpha of the Code of Virginia. Under subsection 1, to consider appointments to boards, committees, and commissions. Under subsection 3, to discuss the acquisition of real property for public uses because an open meeting discussion would adversely affect the bargaining position of the county. Under subsection 7, to consult with legal counsel and staff regarding specific legal matters requiring legal advice relating to the negotiation of an agreement to terminate a contract. And under subsection 7, to consult with legal counsel and staff regarding specific legal matters requiring legal advice relating to public records and meetings.
Second.
Emma. Mr. Snow?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Mr. Boyd?
Yes.
Sorry. Mr. Dumler?
Yes.
Ms. Malik?
Yes.
Mr. Rooker?
Yes.
Mr. Davis, time frame in the meeting upstairs. How much time do we need to budget so we can tell people when to rearrange their schedules to come back later?
Probably about an hour and 15 minutes, I would guess.
Okay. So,
Upstairs. Where's that? Seriously, so much. Bringing me something to eat. I think my blood sugar's dropping. Well, I probably should. I'm restarting it, and then, unless you want to do it.
right there on the corner. On the corner.
Only one we get all of them that was. Think it's any. Oh, it's over there. This is the only one.
Acrobatics?
Huh?
Acrobatic.
Oh, I gotta get his too. In my eyes, or does this look funny? That's it, right? Okay.